Parivrajaka Acharya Stotra Sutta Sri Sri Mata's Divine Grace Sabai Charna Vinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada Ki Grantharaj Sri Mata Bhagavatam Ki Jaya Mantakodi Vaishnav Vrinda Ki Jaya. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru in Golanga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Narayanam Namaskritya. Narayanam Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Mudirayet Nasta Prayeshva Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya
Bhagavat
Yutama Shloke dear Bhavati Naishtaki. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Reading this morning from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 1, Questions by Vidura, text number 9. Nine, yeah, that's the one I prepared at least. Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam. Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam. Jagat gurur yani jagada Krishna. Jagat gurur yani jagada Gada Krishna. Natani pumsam amritaya nani. Natani pumsam amritaya nani. Rajo rumene kshata punyalesha. Rajo rumene kshata punyalesha. Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam. Jagat gurur yani jagada Krishna. Natani pumsam amritaya nani. Rajo rumene kshata punyalesha. Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam. Jagat guryani jagada Krishna. Natani pumsam amritaya nani. Natani pumne chata punyalesha. Yadacha parta prahitaya sabhyam. Jagat Guru Yani Jagada Krishna. Natani Pumsam Amritaya Nani. Rajo Rumene Chata Punyalesha. Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam.
Jagat
guru yani jagada Krishna. Natani pumsam amritaya nani. Rajo rumene chata punyalesha.
Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam.
Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam.
Jagat guru yani jagada Krishna.
Natani pumsam amritaya nani.
Rajo
rumene chata punyalesha. Yadacha parta prahita sabhayam. Jagat Guru Yani Jagada Krishna. Natani Pumsam Amritaya Nani. Rajo Rumene Chatapunya Leshaha. I will do the word for word. Yada.
Yada.
When.
When.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Partha Prahita.
Being advised by Arjuna.
Sabhayam.
In the assembly.
Jagat Guru.
The teacher of the world.
Yani.
Those.
Jagada.
Went.
Krishna.
Lord Krishna.
Na.
Never.
Tani.
Such words.
Bumsam.
All men of sense.
Amrita ayanani.
As good as nectar.
Raja.
The king. Dhritarashtra or Duryodhana.
Uru.
Very important.
Mene.
Did consider.
Kshata.
Dwindling.
Punyalesha.
Fragment of pious acts.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada.
Srila Prabhupada ki.
Lord Krishna was sent by Arjuna into the assembly as the spiritual master of the whole world. And although his words were heard by some, like Bhishma, as pure nectar, it was not so for others who were completely bereft of the last farthing of past pious works. The king, Dhritarashtra or Duryodhana, did not take the words of Lord Krishna very seriously.
Purport.
Lord Krishna, who is the spiritual master of the entire universe, accepted the duty of a messenger and, deputed by Arjuna, went to the assembly of King Dhritarashtra on a peace mission. Krishna is everyone's lord, yet because he was the transcendental friend of Arjuna, he gladly accepted the role of messenger, exactly like an ordinary friend. That is the beauty of the Lord's behavior with his pure devotees. He reached the assembly and spoke about peace, and the message was relished by Bhishma and other great leaders because it was spoken by the Lord himself. But due to the exhaustion of the pious results of past deeds, Duryodhana, or his father Dhritarashtra, did not take the message very seriously. That is the way of persons who have no credit of pious deeds. By past pious deeds, one may become the king of a country, but because the results of the pious acts of Duryodhana and company were dwindling, it became evident from their actions that they were sure to lose the kingdoms to the Pandavas. The message of Godhead is always like nectar to the devotees, but it is just the opposite to the non-devotees. Sugar candy is always sweet to a healthy man, but it tastes very bitter to persons suffering from jaundice. Om Angyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmaya Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitayena Pitale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadanti Kam Vanshakalpatirubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Ebhacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shachai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
So much going on in this little short purport in this verse here. So we've crossed the threshold into Canto 3 of the Bhagavatam here.
Canto 3, sneaky, one of my favorite cantos.
Not only because of the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya and the narration of Vidura's leaving the Kaurava court in a bit of a huff, as we say, or a bit of a tizzy. We'll get to that in a moment. Also the teachings of Kapiladeva are in the third canto, in which the theistic Sankhya philosophy is elucidated in great detail. So we ended the second canto. The second canto is when we first saw, we saw Maharaj Parikshit and Sukadeva Goswami appear at the very end of the first canto, which as I've said and other people have said innumerable times, the first canto that we read of the Bhagavatam is like a prelude to the Bhagavatam that was spoken by Sukadeva Goswami to King Parikshit. And so at the end of Dvapara Yuga, the beginning of Kali Yuga, all of the sages gathered at Naimisharanya to engage in religious activities, what they thought was pious spiritual activities, and through making a gigantic fire yagya. And as it is explained, the only thing that they managed to produce from their gigantic fire yagya was a bunch of smoke. And so they're like, well, what is going on here? and then Sukadeva Goswami, so they invited Suta Goswami to come speak. What's going on here, Suta Goswami? And Suta Goswami basically narrated the last section of the Mahabharata from the Battle of Kurukshetra onwards to set the stage for the conversation between Sukadeva Goswami and King Parikshit, which is normally what is taken as the Bhagavatam proper. Although there are so many embedded conversations within the Bhagavatam, and here we're about to start on another one. And so Sukadeva Goswami started preaching to Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit basically asked Sukadeva Goswami, what is the duty of a dying man in the material world? I'm about to die. I have achieved the pillar of success of the entire universe, for the most part, as far as human beings are concerned. King Parikshit was at the top of his game when he gave up his kingdom. He was at the peak of his prowess, but he got this message that you are going to die in 7 days. And so he didn't milk the peak of his prowess for all it was worth. He didn't rest on his laurels. What do you mean I'm going to die? I'm the king. I'm not going to die. I'm in the prime of my life. This is the mentality that most people have. And the younger you get, the less likely you are, I think, to think that you could die at any moment. We could, of course, all die at any moment. For good reason, for bad reason. I belong to a group on Facebook called the Darwin Awards, which is just videos of people doing incredibly stupid things. So sometimes people die for good reason. Sometimes people die for no good reason. We see sometimes young children getting cancer or other terminal diseases. And we have to wonder, what could this child possibly have done to deserve this? But we don't know. Other times we also see the people thriving for no good reason. We see people at all rungs of our government. I was told not to make, I signed a piece of paper, actually agreeing not to be political while giving Bhagavatam class, but because this verse and this purport is somewhat political, I'm giving myself a little bit of a license. Anyway, we see crooks and cheaters and criminals at every rung of our government everywhere, yet these people seem to act with impunity, no consequences. And in the meantime, ordinary living entities, they do one little thing wrong, they make one innocent mistake, and then it's like the entire world is collapsing in on them. So the ways of material nature are very difficult to understand. And the manner in which every living entity is quite specifically and in great detail entangled in their karma is also very difficult to understand. And we see this throughout the Bhagavatam. King Parikshit, he was cursed by the son of a Brahmana to die in 7 days for, yeah, he did something he shouldn't have. Maybe he acted in a way that was a little bit out of the norms of social customs of that time, but it wasn't a huge offense. The person who was the victim of the so-called offense wasn't even offended. In fact, the person who was offended by Maharaj Parikshit putting the snake around his neck, he was apologetic. Oh, I should have woken up and given Maharaj some water. His son was very upset. He cursed Maharaj Parikshit to die, and Maharaj Parikshit immediately gave up his kingdom. We all know the story. And there he met Sukadeva Goswami, and they began to discuss. And one of the things that King Parikshit asked Sukadeva Goswami is, can you narrate the pastimes of the incarnations of the Lord? And this is a major theme in the Bhagavatam, the incarnations of the Lord on this earth. And Sukadeva Goswami began by kind of giving a list of all the incarnations of the Lord, the scheduled incarnations of the Lord, I think is the name of the chapter. And then he started to unpack a little bit in, with much greater detail the conversation between Lord Brahma and Krishna. And so this is the bulk of the second canto, actually, is Sukadeva Goswami beginning to unpack the Bhagavatam. The original four verses of our Bhagavatam, the Chatusloki Bhagavatam, is found in the second canto. And Sukadeva Goswami elaborates on this, and he expands this further and further and further. And we get in the second canto a healthy dose of two of the main themes of the Bhagavatam, which are Sarga and Visarga. So Sarga is the creation of all of the material worlds, and Visarga is the creation within the material worlds. So Krishna creates all of the material universes by his mystic slumber and his breathing. And then within each universe, he empowers a living entity, or sometimes he will appear himself as Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma is not the creator of the material universe, but he is the engineer of everything that is within the material universe. And so Sukadeva Goswami, by narrating this conversation between Lord Brahma and Narada Muni, elaborates on both of these themes in quite some detail. It's not very long, but it will take a lifetime to understand what it means. And it can actually factually only be understood by discussing these things in the presence of the devotees. So especially at the end of the second canto, the chapter 9, chapter 10, there's a lot of metaphysics. There's a lot of information about how consciousness is a fundamental part of the world that we live in. This is very different than what scientists will tell you these days, and it is for this reason, this was the main central reason why Prabhupada was hammering on scientists so much in his preaching, especially towards the end of his life. We know that Prabhupada was not against science. We read in the preface to the Bhagavatam, for example, that Prabhupada applauds humanity, now we're going back to the late 50s and the early 60s, for having achieved great advancement in the forms of, and he lists a whole bunch of different types of scientific endeavors, medicine, technology, so on and so forth. But there's a pinprick at large, Prabhupada mentioned, and therefore great wars break out even over small conflicts. And when Prabhupada started the Bhaktivedanta Institute, it was very much he wanted the educated class of people that had come to his mission to establish consciousness as an undeniable fact of existence. Consciousness is an indelible part of the world that we live in. That means that consciousness did not arise out of a mature combination of material elements. This is what the modern scientists say, and this, to a certain extent, arises out of Darwin's theory. Darwin himself was not an atheist, and towards the end of his life, Darwin also wrestled with the idea, or with the consequences of his theory, tending towards atheism, or at least creating a worldview in which a god was not required to explain things. And this begins with that life begins from a very simple living entity, and as it evolves over time, it becomes more and more complex to the point where consciousness of the living entity becomes visible. And so we can't really see the consciousness of all the living entities that live in our soil. But we can begin a little bit to see the consciousness of the living entities that are growing out of the soil. There was a scientist who did an experiment to see if plants would respond to fire, for example. And so he had a group of plants and he hooked up a bunch of electrodes to measure electromagnetic vibrations running through the plants. And he would set a baseline, so he'd just leave the plants alone in the room. The plants can happily do their plant thing. But then after he established what the baseline electromagnetic signal running through the plants was, he would go into the room where the plants were and he would start to threaten them with fire. He'd wave fire at them and shout nasty things. "It's gonna burn you, plant." I don't know what he was shouting, but he would wave fire at the plants and the plants would have some kind of response to this, right? And so one could argue, well, this is just a normal biological response to being threatened by fire. But after a while, the plant developed something of a Pavlovian response to this. So the scientists could just go into the room and the plants would have the same electromagnetic response, even if he wasn't waving fire. So the plants were somehow aware of this particular individual's presence. And so we can see that even amongst the non-moving living entities, there is some consciousness that is displayed. And then, of course, we get into animal life. I see my friends Jaini Tai and Juggernaut. They have a pet raccoon in addition to 26 pet cats, it seems. But sometimes I see them there feeding this raccoon, and they're the only people I've ever seen in my life feeding a raccoon. And the raccoon is so peaceful and is happy and is taking the food and is not being aggressive. And this is because the raccoon has some consciousness. The raccoon knows if I go to these nice people's house, they will give me food. This is a function of consciousness, right? Thinking, feeling, and willing. And there are many other examples. So animals have some more developed consciousness. Of course, if we have a pet dog, if we say the dog's name, the dog will respond. We can give the dog basic commands, sit, stand, roll over, fetch, play dead, you know, all the standard dog commands. And so we see that animals exhibit also some consciousness. And then, of course, this consciousness becomes fully manifested in the human form of life, in which we start to develop self-consciousness. We start to become aware of ourselves and our impact on the environment around us and the environment around us's impact on us. And so this is consciousness coming to a mature state in the human form of life. But one of the central points of the second canto of the Bhagavatam, and this gets expanded upon even further by Kapiladeva towards the end of the third canto, is that this consciousness that we're speaking of, it does not arise out of a mature combination of chemicals. It's not that when the khichdi is sufficiently old and has been left on the table in the heat in the summer, after 2 weeks, the khichdi starts bubbling and it will become self-aware. That is not gonna happen. The khichdi needs to go in the compost at that point and can feed innumerable other living entities. No, consciousness is part of the material world. And so this is a very simple thing to understand, or I should say it's a very simple thing to believe. But to understand it, even these two short paragraphs that are at the end of the second canto, this requires quite a lifetime of studying, and it needs to be studied in the association of devotees to come to the proper conclusions. So it's simple, but it's not easy. And then after this whole discussion, after Sukadeva Goswami narrates this conversation, King Pariksit abruptly changes the subject. So Sukadeva Goswami narrates this whole beautiful metaphysical conversation about the creation of the universe, the engineering of our material world, the nature of consciousness, how senses develop, how the bodies develop, how Krishna is connected to and is pervading this whole thing. King Pariksit abruptly says, go back to telling me about how Vidura left the court of the courtless. He very abruptly changes the subject. He's like, I want to go back to that other stuff. I've had enough of this high philosophy. Let me hear some pastimes. Sukadeva Goswami is happy to oblige. So we pick up again now the narration of the Mahabharata, basically, starting when... Well, this verse is speaking about when Lord Krishna himself went into the court of the Kauravas and begged them to call off the war. But before that happened, Vidura had left the court. Somebody said something mean about his mom, and he stormed into the court, and he let them all have it, and then he stormed out. And so King Pariksit, who was Vidura's great nephew, right? Vidura was the brother of Pariksit's grandfather. Is that right? No, he was the brother of Vidura's great... Vidura was the brother of Pariksit's great-grandfather. Yeah. So Dhritarashtra would have been one of Pariksit's great-granduncles. I think I'm getting this right. Yeah, thank you. And so Vidura had some standing. Vidura and Dhritarashtra were brothers, and of course the three brothers that were born of Vyasadeva, who was filling in for Bhishma. Bhishma took the great vow of brahmacharya at a young age, which is atypical for kshatriyas. Kshatriyas typically do not take vows of brahmacharya. Kshatriyas typically take vows of many wives because they have so much energy and so much prowess and so much Ishvar Bhav. Ishvar Bhav is the propensity to want to control things, that they don't do well living alone with nothing. But Bhishma was a bit of an exception to this. He took a vow of brahmacharya. This threatened the dynasty, so to speak. And so Vyasadeva was called in as a replacement, as a surrogate father, basically. And nobody really wanted to sleep with Vyasadeva, let's say. He tried a few times, and there was the mother always had some sort of bad reaction to this, which caused the children to exhibit some flaw. So, of course, we know Dhritarashtra's flaw was that he was blind. And so he was considered unfit for ruling the kingdom. Maharaj Pandu was basically born an albino, which wasn't a material disqualification for ruling the kingdom, but it was a bit odd. And so they tried again, and then Vidura was born, but Vidura was born of a mixed caste. So Vidura was not of a caste at that time that was typically suited for ruling the kingdom. And so the ruling of the kingdom kind of fell to Pandu, but Pandu wasn't all that into it, right? Pandu kind of said, okay, I'll rule the kingdom from this nice little forest ashram. And so in some way, Pandu prematurely renounced his duty as the ruler of the kingdom. And this caused a lot of problems. Right? So the lesson here is that we cannot prematurely give up our duties in the Vanashram system. Problems will arise. So we were discussing in our Bhakta courses from the we've been reading the Nectar of Instruction. In the second verse of the Nectar of Instruction, there is this term Niyamagraha, which is also translated as Niyamagraha. Niyama. So a Niyama is a rule and a regulation. When we talk about yoga, there are yamas and niyamas. Yamas are regulations that dictate or suggest how we should relate to the world around us. So we should be nonviolent. We should tell the truth. We should practice austerity, which means we shouldn't just hanker for grabbing after everything that we want. We should not steal. We should be non-envious. These are the five niyamas. These are the five yamas. Niyamas, as in niyama agraha or niyama agraha, refer to rules and regulations for how we should go about handling ourselves. So we should be very clean, saucham. We should be satisfied with whatever the Lord is giving us in the moment, santosh. We should, brahmacharya, we should control our sexual desires in a way that they're channeled in towards procreating and not for our own sense gratification. There are a few more that I'm gonna miss. I take it back. There's svadhyaya, which is study of the self. And this is in relation to study of the scriptures. So we should study the scriptures in a self-reflective mood. What does this have to do with me? What does this mean about me? What can I learn from this? So we should be self-reflective. And then finally, Ishvara Pranidhan. We should surrender our lives to Krishna. These are the niyamas of yoga, of Ashtanga yoga. Rupa Goswami talks about niyama agraha. So there are many, many rules and regulations to practicing Krishna consciousness. We have from Srila Sanatan Goswami and Gopal Bhatta Goswami, the Hari Bhakti Vilas, which is an encyclopedia of rules and regulations. How to wash your hands, how to follow a kadashi, how to fast properly, how to sleep properly, what should you do when you wake up, how to worship the deity, who is qualified to worship the deity, how can you qualify yourself to worship the deity. So many rules and regulations. And this term niyama agraha can mean either I'm just not going to follow them, I'm going to do my own thing, chant Hare Krishna according to my own design. But there's also niyama agraha, which is to follow the rules and regulations that are designed for somebody else. So we are all individual living entities, and as I mentioned previously, we are all uniquely and individually entangled in material life. And so one person's path out of this world, when you look at the details of it, is not necessarily going to be the same as somebody else's. And we should not do somebody else's service, even perfectly, at the neglect of our own service. And so we saw this a little bit with Maharaj Pandu. Maharaj Pandu was not perfectly positioned to be the king due to some bodily defect, but he was the most qualified person, and it was his duty to be the king. He decided he wanted to be a sage, and he was an excellent sage. I mean, they went out into the woods, and he was really a first-class sage. So he did somebody else's duty perfectly, and this led to a lot of problems down the line. Dhritarashtra had to fill in his stead, and Dhritarashtra, being more favorably disposed to his own children over the children of his brother, his nephews, he made a lot of politics to make sure that Duryodhana and company stayed in power. As well they should. They were also Kshatriyas. And Duryodhana and company, we should also mention, they were not bad rulers. Not like, for example, I want to say Maharaj Venu. Is that his name, the father of King Prithu? Venu, was it? Something back there. Yeah. Venu is something else. I knew that wasn't. Maharaj Vena. He was a bad ruler. He destroyed Brahminical culture. He oppressed people. He stole and misused people's wealth, and so on and so forth. So he did a bad job. Duryodhana was ruling under, you know, with Dhritarashtra sort of as the figurehead. People were kind of satisfied with their rule. The brahmanas were worshipped, the streets were clean, people were healthy. So it's not that Duryodhana and company were bad rulers, it's that they were not, they didn't have Krishna in the center of their rule. And so therefore the whole thing became disruptive. But we also see that they started to become kind of abusive, right? In order to protect their hold on power, they started to commit many offenses, right? Starting with trying to murder their cousins in all kinds of various ways. And even the cousins said, look, we are Kshatriyas. We need to fulfill our duty as Kshatriyas. Just give us each a little village and we'll get out of your way. But the Kauravas were so attached to power and so attached to this Ishvara Bhav, this desire to control things, that they wouldn't even do that. And so all of the politics broke loose, right? There were so many negotiations, so many people tried to talk sense into Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana. And as this verse is saying, not even Krishna could talk sense into these people. Not even Krishna could talk sense into these people. And what they had done was so obviously wrong. Also, this was not a nuanced situation with everything that transpired between the Kauravas and the Pandavas, culminating, of course, in the violent, I don't know what word I want to use here, let's say disrobing of Draupadi in the court. I mean, this is obviously a heinous crime that nobody should stand for and that everybody should speak out against. We can tolerate so many things in our world, but the two things that we cannot tolerate are abuse against women and children, because these are, in fact, our most precious resources. These are our most precious resources. So we can tolerate many, many, many things on our own behalf or on the behalf of other people, but we should not tolerate abuse against women and children. And yet we see that great souls in the court of the Kauravas, starting with Bhishmadev, he stood by and watched and did nothing while Draupadi was being abused. He did nothing. He sat there dumbfounded, or maybe he stood there dumbfounded. And they even asked him, Bhishmadev, aren't you going to say something? Can't you say something? And he was completely bewildered, actually. He was completely bewildered. And I'm paraphrasing Krishna Dharma Prabhu's translation of the Mahabharata now, but when Bhishmadev was called out, he basically shrugged his shoulders and said, I don't know what to do. The ways of virtue are very difficult to understand. Why? It's because he was beholden to the Kauravas. The Kauravas were supporting his life. There was money involved. And so it's like, what do? I owe my maintenance to these people. I can't call them out. But at the same time, this is so obviously wrong. What do I do? And so we see this often in the world. In every endeavor in the material world, there is some fault. Nobody is perfect. Nobody is perfect in this world. Everybody is making mistakes. Most of us are making mistakes all the time. All the time, if we're honest with ourselves. And so we should not be surprised when there's some discrepancy or when there's some disagreement amongst the management, or in I'm talking in any situation here. in any situation. We should not be surprised when somebody in a position of authority or a position of leadership does something that we don't agree with or does something that appears to be wrong. This is not a mystery. The question is how to handle it. And so we see here that even in the face of literally the most egregious sins committed by the Kauravas, and it didn't end with the disrobing of Draupadi. It kind of started with that, or that was kind of the middle of it. We also know that the five sleeping grandchildren of the Pandavas were murdered in their sleep. He did not quite get away with that. Ashvatthama did not quite get away with it. Apparently, he's still wandering around hopelessly in this world for the rest of forever. But even Krishna could not correct them. And so we see that there's always this push and this pull within any society. There's the leadership of the society who is doing their best to keep things on track. And then there's the rank and file in the society who might have some grievance. And they go about all kinds of ways to voice their grievances to the management or whatever. But what do they expect? Not even Krishna could talk sense into the Kauravas, even though the Kauravas were engaged in what obviously was the most heinous sinful activity. Even Krishna couldn't talk any sense to them. So what is our position? First, we have to understand what is our standing. If we want to lodge a complaint, or if we want to affect change within the society that we live in, we first of all have to understand, what is my position? What is my standing? When we teach in our physical and health education curriculum, in general, in our middle school and high school, we talk about approaches to learning, which are what is commonly called soft skills. So we're not learning the details of how to do geometry or how chemicals work, but we're learning soft skills about learning that can be applied to many different contexts. And so there's whole lists of these things that are given to us by the curriculum that we follow. And one of them is negotiating win-win outcomes with peers and authorities. Negotiating win-win outcomes with peers and authorities. So first of all, there's negotiating mutual beneficial outcomes. And then there's also different groups of people that we're negotiating with. I can negotiate with my friends. What do we want for dinner? I don't know. But sometimes we also need to negotiate with authorities. Like, something's going on, this isn't working for me, how can we go about to affect change in such a way that I'm getting what I want, but the authority is not losing control of the situation they want to maintain, which they have a right and a duty to maintain. So we need to understand what our position is. Negotiating begins with leverage. If you want to negotiate with somebody, you need to have some leverage, right? I'm bringing this point up because if we want to affect change in our lives, these are things to consider before we go into negotiating. And of course, our kids at the school, they have so much leverage with their teachers because we really need them to behave, right? They need to stop making so much noise. So they have some leverage there. And of course, we have leverage over the students too, because if we don't like what we're doing, we can send an email to their parents, right? And the parents may or may not do something, but eventually they will get sick of all the emails we send them, and then they may do something. And so here we see that although Krishna has all the leverage in the world, he was not able to affect peaceful change here because the people who are in a position of power were not actually sincere. They were holding on to power for their own personal sense gratification, and they were not holding on to power because they had the prowess and it was their duty to elevate the masses to Krishna consciousness according to the Vanashram system. And so that's a little bit what's going on in this verse. And last, maybe I'll take 5 minutes just to comment a little bit on how this affects Vidura and Dhritarashtra. So Vidura did have some status with calling out Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra was Vidura's older brother. And so this is a family relationship. This is not necessarily a relationship of ruled and rulers. This is a familial relationship. And one could also argue that Vidura had as much claim to the throne as Dhritarashtra did. namely that neither of them had any claim to it, other than parenting gone wrong. And so Vidura, he had some standing to chastise Dhritarashtra. He wasn't just some guy off the street who wanted to come yell at the king. And so he did. He chastised Dhritarashtra quite severely. He basically told Dhritarashtra that even after losing this war, you are so attached to your material comfort and you're so attached to your position of power that you're willing to eat like a dog out of the hands of the people that just defeated your whole family. Very sharp words Vidura preached to Dhritarashtra. So when the time came to make the sauce, there was plenty of chili pepper in that sauce. This is a cooking metaphor. Seeing if anybody's still there. Yeah. So Vidura didn't hold back. And Dhritarashtra, because Dhritarashtra was not completely bereft of pious credits, Dhritarashtra heard it. He thought, actually, you are right. And he left. He left immediately. And he just walked into the forest. And he kept walking into the forest until he finally sat down and let himself be consumed by his own yogic prowess. He self-immolated, spontaneous combustion of Dhritarashtra. And so although there are so many faults that we can see in these stories, the story of how the Pandavas and the Kauravas entered into prolonged negotiations for trying to settle the matter, how even Krishna got involved as a menial servant of Arjuna, how that didn't work, and how Dhritarashtra was so badly behaved, and he had no shame in his living, that he needed to be heavied out by his younger brother. So we see so many faults in these stories. We see so many people behaving badly, but we also see so many perfect examples of what is to be done in these stories. And we also see the consequences of what happens if we don't do what's supposed to be done. So Bhishma, although he was a Mahajan, literally, one of the 12 great authorities on spiritual matters, because he did not stand up and speak against the abuse of women and children in a public sphere where he had the full agency to do so, he was forced to suffer quite extremely at the end of his life. And instead of just going back to Godhead blissfully like we all hope to do one day, he had to lie on a bed of arrows for a long time before he left his body. He's pierced by 1,000 arrows and left to lie there. I mean, I know sometimes I do some martial arts in the park and I have nunchaku, and sometimes I accidentally nick myself with a nunchaku, and that is very painful and it leaves a huge welt and a bruise. I can't imagine actually getting pierced by an arrow, but to speak of getting pierced by 1,000 arrows and then having to lie on them. So this was what Bhishma reaped by what he sowed, by not standing up in the face of the greatest injustice. Of course, being a Mahajan, this was also a pastime, and we know that Bhishma left his body at a time, place, and circumstance of his choosing. But before he did that, while he was lying on the bed of arrows, what did he preach about? He preached about Varna Ashram Dharma. He preached about what the duty of human beings are in the various stages and occupations of their lives. This was the lecture that he gave, because he understood who he was speaking to. This was not the conversation between Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy, where the deepest, most intimate pastimes of Radha and Krishna were being revealed. This was a lesson for how ordinary living entities should make their way, slow, steady, deliberate, step by step, back to Godhead. As we know, Prabhupada writes in the purport in the Bhagavad Gita that from the beginning of Karma Yoga to the topmost platform of Bhakti is a long way to go. And so to go along that way, we need to follow the rules and regulations that are designed for us. So first of all, we need to understand, what is our position in life? What is my varna? What is my ashram? Ashrams tend to be pretty easy to figure out. They go by age. You know, young people should be brahmacharis. What does brahmachari mean? We typically think of brahmachari as somebody who's just not having sexual relationships with anybody, but actually brahmachari means so much more than that. Brahma acharya. Brahmachari means acharya, the achar, the conduct that leads to brahman, So what is the conduct that leads to Brahman realization? This is a lot more than just abstaining from sexuality. This is how to speak to people. This is how to render service to people. This is how to see what service needs to be done without being asked, right? I see this needs to be done, I do it. We hear there are three types of servants in the world. There's the one type of servant who will be asked to do something and they will do it begrudgingly. All right, they asked me to go wash the pots. I guess I'll go wash the pots. Okay, whatever. There's another type of servant who will be asked to do something and they'll do it joyfully and they'll do a reasonably good job of it. This is a second-class servant. And then the topmost servant knows what needs to be done without being asked and will do it and will do an excellent job of it. Right? So these are the levels of service. So brahmacharya is for being trained up to become a first-class servant, because when you get married and have children, you're going to need to be that all the time. You need to be that all the time. There's no break from it. So that's brahmacharya. Grihastha is expanding. So grihasthas are responsible for economic development. This is a duty that grihasthas have. When I was living in Germany, I was often lamenting the fact that the German government had such a strong social welfare system that many of the grihastha devotees could just live off of tax dollars. They just, the government would pay their health insurance, they'd pay for an apartment, and they'd give them a little bit of spending cash every month. And so they didn't need to work. But actually, grihasthas need to work. Grihasthas should get a job. And if you don't want to go work, be employed, if it's not your nature to be employed, you need to have some means of economic development. This is the fundamental duty of a grihastha, is to develop the economy around which all of the rest of the society is flourishing. And this is frustrating. Nobody really likes to work, especially working for somebody else. So people get sick of this after a while. And they start to aspire again for a higher spiritual calling, and this is called vanaprastha. So vanaprastha should remove themselves from the general masses of society. They should take to the deliberate practice of austerities and penances by traveling around to the holy places, hearing from the sages there, and engaging in community service. And when this becomes mature, at the end of somebody's life, they take sannyas. Sannyas means social suicide. Means you are no longer alive to society. You don't have a position, you don't have power, you don't have a family. Your job is to travel and preach. Not staying, you stay somewhere long enough for them to milk a cow so you can get some nourishment and you can share the Bhagavatam with them, and then moving on. And so this is what Bhishma was explaining at the end of his life, how people, through practicing this Varnashram system, can gradually come to the highest platform. That was a little bit about ashrams. Varnas are also typically not hard to figure out what varna somebody should be in. You just look at what they're doing. People will naturally gravitate towards work that is conducive to their varna. Or you can also see, you can usually tell immediately if somebody comes to the Hare Krishna temple for the first time, you can usually tell what varna they're going to be in. Somebody who is brahminically inclined, they will come to the Hare Krishna temple and they will ask, what is all of this? Who is this on the altar? Why are you doing this? Why are you waving this incense? What are these books? What is this philosophy? They will want to know more about the essence of what we were doing. Somebody who has a propensity to lord it over, to be a kshatriya, they will come in and they'll ask, who's in charge here? They will want to know who the boss is, right? They will also start to see everything that's wrong with the management. Oh, there's a cobweb up there. You know, I do this whenever I go into a devotee kitchen for the first time. Just the judgments start pouring out of my mind. Everything, every little speck of dirt that should be there. Look at this. Who's cleaning this? So that's my Ishvara Bhav. Vaishyas want to know, who's paying for all this, right? How do you guys afford all this? We had somebody come into our temple while I was living in a small preaching center in the Green Lake area of Seattle. We had like a three-bedroom house that we were doing Sankirtan out of. And we started doing Sunday feasts after a while. And somebody came to the Sunday feast once and literally asked this question, how do you afford this place? And the temple president said, don't ask, otherwise it won't happen. So we don't really know how we afford this place, but Krishna keeps giving it, so don't ask any questions. And somebody who is a worker, a laborer, they will come to the temple and they will want to do some work. They will go looking for the pots to clean. They will want to serve prasadam. Although serving prasadam is a transcendental activity. All of this is transcendental activity. So people are naturally inclined to the work that they have a natural inclination for, and they should be engaged accordingly. This takes quite some expertise on the part of the management, because the management wants things for themselves, but we need to engage people properly. And so Dhritarashtra was no longer engaged properly. His use as a proxy ruler had served its purpose, and now he wasn't doing anything except eating and sleeping. And so he needed to move on in his life. He needed to move on to the next stage, and he needed a jolt to do that. And so it was his good qualification that he was able to hear from Vidura. So we have Vidura had some standing to deliver a complaint. And then we had the management, Dhritarashtra, had some qualification to effectively hear the complaint. And so this is how it should go, although it took a long, long time. It took many, many, many decades of Dhritarashtra not hearing before he finally heard. And what did Vidura do? Basically, Vidura appealed to his sense of shame, right? He saw that the man was so attached to his ego, all I could do is point out what a pathetic situation he had put himself in. Anyway, we're running out of time. I'll stop rambling now. Any questions or comments? Mother Ragatmika. So we're just getting started on these pastimes of Vidura and Maitreya and Dhritarashtra, so I'm sure we'll hear a lot more in the coming weeks.
So as you describe this about Bhishma Dev and not speaking up, how is it that the Pandavas held respect for him at the end and would listen to him? It would seem like he's not even practicing what he's preaching.
Yeah, this I will give you Bhishma's answer to. I don't know. The ways of virtue are, in fact, really hard to understand. And it's easy to see from a Brahminical place. The answer I'll give you, and I'm speaking my opinion now, having been in management and administration at different points in my life, it's difficult to understand what a manager or a leader or a mayor or a temple president or whatever it is, whatever managerial position is, it's difficult to understand all of the different ropes that are pulling these people in 5,000 different directions are, excuse me, until you've had to do it yourself. So from a Brahminical perspective, it's very plain to see what the fact of the matter is and what should be done and what should not to be done. And the difference between a Brahmana and a Kshatriya is that the Kshatriya has to get their hands dirty with this. So they have to take the advice from the Brahmanas, but then they need to practically implement it. And as soon as you get into practically implementing it, it becomes a little bit more complicated because there are competing interests and there's different infrastructure that needs to be maintained. Yeah, there are competing interests. So we may see something that we don't like going on, but if that were to stop going on, what would the fallout of that be? And we can stand in a position of righteousness and say, no, it needs to stop. But are you prepared to deal with the fallout? We saw, not you, but is one prepared to deal with the fallout? So we saw this, a good example of this is when the United States under George W. Bush invaded Iraq, toppled the dictator there who, you know, probably needed some toppling. But the next thing the United States government did is that they fired everybody that was in Saddam Hussein's government. They outlawed the Ba'ath Party. So there was one party in Iraq, the Ba'ath Party. They all worked for Saddam Hussein. And not only did they topple Saddam Hussein, they threw out the Ba'ath Party. And the result of this was there was nobody left to run this country. And that turned what could have been a one-year military operation into a 10-year-long war with insurgency. So the Pandavas were sensitive to what it means to rule things. And it also, because they had to do it. Also, the premise of your question is, it's hard to understand. I mean, I see, did they really respect him? I mean, they tried to kill him. They did kill him. They murdered him on the battlefield. But it's also, I mean, I have a very close friend here in this community, a mentor and a friend who, things happen in ISKCON, things happen locally, things have happened historically, and I find myself often disagreeing with this person's position on this to a point where it's like outrageous, like, wow, this guy is so wrong about so many things. Why do I still feel so much love and affection for him? You know, I'm not in a position to call him out publicly. I will often demur or defend him if people start pointing this out. And why? It's like the same thing. Why am I so conflicted here? And honestly, we don't really choose who our friends are. We don't really choose who we fall in love with. It's just there are modes of nature that we're drawn to. And, you know, Lord Balaram was friends. This is what I tell myself about this person. Lord Balaram was friends with Duryodhana. So I can be friends with this person. It's okay. It's okay. So I think, management is hard, you know, and it's thankless, you know, and it's very easy to see a manager and complain about them because we see so many faults in so many places throughout the world. Everywhere we go, there's so many faults. It's very easy to complain about the management, but people who have had other experience in management, I find, are less eager to do so because they know what it's like, you know. I mean, they know what it's like to have an ideal but then have a practical reality, right? We also see that in Vedic culture, people are just respectful to each other, you know. The Pandavas were very humble, you know, so I don't know. It's a complicated question.
Mm-hmm. Also, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada points out that due to exhaustion of the benefit, the credits of pious activities, can one increase another person's stock of pious activity, pious credits, by performing some service or something on behalf of that individual?
Well, we can pray for people, and you know, I believe firmly in the power of prayer.
We can't say, I'm doing this service on for the benefit of, or on behalf of, this other person. They get the credit for doing it.
That's a question for Srimati Radharani.
Oh.
I'm not going to speak on her behalf right now. I don't know. That's one and two, and then we'll call it a day.
I wanted to comment on, you were talking about the ashrams. You could tell what ashram that a person might be in. However, sometimes a person could be a great Sankirtan devotee, book distributor in the daytime, come back in the evening and wash pots, and then serve out prasadam on Sunday.
Yeah.
So it's not so cut and dry what ashram one is in or what propensity he may have.
Well, anything, that's a good point. Anything can be performed with a brahminical mentality, and a brahmana should be expert at doing everything. A brahmana is expert at doing everything. So a brahmana should be able to clean a pot like nobody's business. A brahmana should be able to lead kirtan like a true Gandharva. So what differentiates it here is the mentality in which it's being performed. So somebody who's going out and doing sankirtan all day and coming back and doing service on the altar or in the kitchen or on the grounds or whatever at night, this person has risen above these material designations. In fact, they are doing devotional service, right? Of course, the great example is our Jayananda Prabhu, who was engaged in what would appear to be Shudra-like activities, building things, driving cars, like that. But, you know, by his own admission, Srila Prabhupada said that this person came here with me. He didn't use these words, but, you know, Prabhupada recognized him as one of his eternal associates. So there are also pastimes that we see among certain devotees, but we should not really apply that to us, right? I should not think that I am that. I should think, what am I good at doing? And I should do that for Krishna. So what am I good at doing? And it becomes quite clear what is the proper varna for that. Yeah. So there's, in devotional service, these things are transcended, but we need to come to the platform of devotional service first before it becomes transcendental like that.
In regards to Mother Radhika's question about the Mahajana, I was thinking how these people were of such different high character that we can't even imagine. I mean, if you look at, forget about Bhishma, who was further distant in the relationship.
Yeah.
Just think about Draupadi and her husbands. And as her husbands, who didn't speak up. It was her husbands. And not only that they didn't speak up, look at Draupadi's reaction. Mother Gatmika was saying, how did they maintain respect for Bhishma Dev? How did Draupadi, right after she is being disrobed, she asks, when she was asked for two boons, she still had so much faith in her husband, who did not protect her right now, right there, did not protect her.
Yeah.
She asked for them to have the weapons. She said, let them get their, each one get their weapons. So what? To do what? To do their work of protection. So these people's character is just beyond our understanding. And what's interesting is that Krishna has arranges for somebody like Yudhishthira Maharaj, who is religious personified, and Bhishma Dev, a Mahajan, to make such take such actions.
Yeah.
And show them that how they're such great Vaishnavas. So I think that we can have some in our hearts some compassion towards those of us who make mistakes.
Yeah.
And still consider them that it's not the end of the world.
Thank God. Yeah, I think that's a great point. I'll just finish on this, that we, these people were embodying, these people were embodying Vedic culture. And we throw this term Vedic culture around quite loosely without really knowing what it is. I was distributing the Sunday feast a couple of weeks ago, and there was somebody, not just one person, there were 300 people pushing to get into the line while the other 500 people were waiting patiently. And I said, why don't you let the women and children eat first? And there was a man standing next to me who said, actually in Vedic culture, the women and children are supposed to eat at the end. And I was like, what? No. And so if that's Vedic culture, I don't want to have anything to do with it, frankly. But our idea of Vedic culture, I've read a lot of Carl Jung in my life. Carl Jung talks a lot about people in the West trying to transplant Eastern spiritual cultures into their own spiritual culture. And he cautions against this very strongly. Carl Jung was the original Krishna West guy, I guess you could say. Because he said, because we take a very mature culture, like Bhishma and Duryodhana, and these people were, although we don't agree with all their actions, they were very ripe as humans. They were advanced like this. But to take such a high culture like that and try to superimpose it on our relatively young, immature, inexperienced culture, it doesn't work right. We get a lot of imitating, you know, Mataji this and Prabhu that. But there's no genuine respect and understanding behind it. It's just we're echoing words. And so we should understand what courtesy is in our own culture, and we should add Krishna to it. And then it becomes Krishna culture. We don't need to adopt the cultural trappings of other people. I mean, in America, if something like this had happened to Draupadi, they would not have gone into exile for 13 years before starting a war. There would be violence immediately. And so exercising that restraint is also culture, but it shouldn't be done artificially. Go ahead. Sorry.
First of all, thank you, Madhamati. That was an excellent example.
Yeah.
The way you described that. You said that our greatest resource is women and children. Can you please expand on that?
Well, children are definitely our greatest resource, because everything that we build in our lives, they will need to maintain, right? There's a saying, I forgot exactly what it is. I know Africa's a big place, that if you want to do something for right now, cook some rice. If you want to do something for 20 years, plant trees. If you want to do something for 100 years, educate children. Because we don't own this place. what we have, we will pass on to our successive generations. And if we don't train our successive generations in how to use their energies, the material energy of the world around us, and natural resources wisely, there will be none of this. And we are headed that way quite quickly. There's no doubt that children are the most beneficial, the most valuable resource in any society. Yeah, well, you're not going to have a lot of children without any women.
Or men.
One man can create a lot of children.
Well,
you need
at least one.
You need at least one, yes. Are you... Anyway, I keep my off color. Are you wrong?
Hey,
yes. That's a fair point. I think that's an area where we can have some agreeable plurality of vision. It comes, you know, obviously we're not just creating children because we want more children in the world. We want to raise children to be Krishna consciousness. So the Brahminical culture underpinning that, of course, yes, is equally important. But Brahminical culture is nothing if there are no people in the culture. There's no culture without people. So it's hard to put one before the other, I'd say.
Oh, yeah, so you actually need people. I mean, Prabhupada really emphasizes the forms of the Brahminical institution. So if you have a bunch of Kshatriyas running in the name of being a Brahminical people or Vaishyas, then you do have problems because they're predominantly influenced by a sort of non-Brahminical
mode. Yeah.
So, you know, if you really have realized people in Christian consciousness, you can actually institute these principles as
yeah.
opposed to. Of course, it's good to just idealize and talk about them because first the thought and then the action. But
no, there needs to be realization,
but at some
for
point
sure.
You gotta kind of talk.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree.
Well, mark the date. Stita and I are agreeing. All right, let's put this to rest for now. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Thank you.